Welcome to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
I think the fundamental fact to grasp about Puritan culture as it differs from our own is that these are people who lived in what has been called an enchanted world, in the sense that every event, no matter how small, was a function or an emanation of the will of God.
The hand of God in the most trivial...
We don't associate legends with the Greeks. We don't go back that far to look for the origins of what we call modern legends.
No, we don't. We speak about the legend as maybe it is originating from lesser mythology. Mm-hmm. But it has been desacralized. It has no sacred connotations
or
connections.
It's utterly secular.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. All right, now you mentioned the medieval. Legend and belief this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For Halloween Week 1991, listen now for conversations with Andrew DelBanco of Columbia University and Linda Day of Indiana University. First, Andrew DelBanco discusses Puritanism, evil, and belief in North American culture. Following that, Linda Day talks about legends in the modern world. According to Andrew DelBanco, the history of 17th century New England can be seen as a contest between two competing conceptions of evil, as an active entity or as the absence of the divine. These competing notions underscore subsequent representations of evil in American culture. Andrew DelBanco.
I think the fundamental fact to grasp about Puritan culture as it differs from our own is that these are people who lived in what has been called an enchanted world, in the sense that every event, no matter how small, was a function or an emanation of the will of God.
The hand of God in the most trivial, commonplace kinds of occurrences.
Exactly. Now, this is not to say that every Puritan layman, certainly not even every Puritan minister, though they were not renowned for their modesty, felt entitled to or equipped to interpret the meaning of every event. But that the meaning was there was not to be doubted.
Mm-hmm. I remember a scholar at the University of North Carolina talking about the Puritans in, how did he put it? They had this delicious, palpable sense of living in a fallen world. Tell me about the sense of original sin that permeated this culture. What did that mean to these people?
Well, it meant a number of things. It meant, first of all, that the natural senses were not to be relied upon, that the world as a whole was fallen, including nature, and so that one had to be aware that one lived in a universe that was permeated with two kinds of fallenness, or two kinds of evil in our terms. Moral evil, which is the evil actions or the evil will of morally responsible beings, and natural evil, the catastrophes or disasters or misfortunes that befell the inhabitants of such a world. Natural evil, drought or fire or shipwreck, for instance, would not elicit from the 17th century sensibility anything like the kind of response that it's likely to elicit from us. If, as happens to all of us at some time or other in our lives, something befalls us, which we wish we had been able to avoid, we think in terms of misfortune. We use that word fortune or luck, bad luck. Now, luck and fortune are concepts that one can almost make the blanket statement simply did not exist in the 17th century.
What, it was too vague for these people?
It was not a matter of vagueness, it was a matter of blasphemy.
It wasn't connected to the deity.
To speak in terms of luck or fortune was to suggest that there was some irrational force in the universe or some way in which the events of our lives or the structure of nature itself or the structure of history were some kind of random game. Mm-hmm. Now, it does seem to me, and I've written about this, I suppose, somewhat controversially, that within Puritanism and therefore within the original dynamic of American culture, there was a kind of internal argument going on as to whether the best way to understand this fallenness, this inability to reach the divine, is to think of it as a blot, an obstacle, a physical obstruction, a thing that must be expelled first by isolation and identification and then various forms of radical therapy. And you find in certain Puritan sermons a good deal of surgical metaphor, uh-huh. The metaphors of poison and corruption and so on. That's one way to think about this problem, and I suppose that's the way that we tend to think of Puritanism. We think of these black-frocked, grim characters walking around pointing the finger at at the cesspool, which is the heart of their neighbor.
Now, that brings us evil as a positive, palpable force in the universe.
Right.
By contrast,
the alternative view, which I would associate with the tradition deriving from Augustine, is the notion of imperfection in the sense of incompletion. That is, the self unable to reach and open itself fully to the beauty of the divine, the moral and aesthetic beauty of the divine. And if you proceed on that premise, you find a rather different kind of preaching. You find a preaching which is more consolatory, more a more beckoning kind of preaching that offers the gracious experience, the conversion experience, as available if only you will open yourself to it. Now, these two views are, of course, closely related, and one is never entirely exclusive of the other. One shouldn't exaggerate the distinction. But they do represent, I think, two themes which operate in early American culture and which in some modified ways, I think, persist to the present day.
Well, let's move into the present day here. We're going to take this enormous leap in time, Andy Del Banco. Human nature doesn't change that much. Have we lost altogether this sense of the fallen world that the Puritans lived in?
Well, I think, as I was trying to suggest last time, that we really that we're really no longer able to participate in this conversation.
Why is this?
Because we have no secure sense that there are any absolute standards by which we can speak coherently or even intelligibly about what constitutes evil. Now, I can give you an example that might bridge the gap between the 17th century and our present moment. When the Puritan ministry in the late 17th century went out to persecute those hapless witches, in quotation marks, the primary grounds upon which they secured their conviction were the grounds of what they called spectral evidence.
Spectral evidence.
Spectral evidence. Right. Now, this meant that if you were most likely a young woman, and you in the middle of the night or on some other appropriate occasion, the image of someone in the community came to you, into your mind, and solicited certain kind of behavior from you, or encouraged you to break the rules of the social group.
What, I could go to the ministers and say, "Hey, look, I'm being influenced here by evil forces."
Exactly. So and so has sent to me her specter, uh-huh. which has come to me in the night and has tempted me. Which was acceptable evidence, at least in some circles, and that became a legal issue, but was for a while acceptable evidence that this accused woman was in cahoots with Satan himself.
Well, now, wait a minute. This is going to create a society in which people are either, profoundly fearful of talking to one another about one another, or a society in which everybody's out to get everybody.
Well, I think that's a pretty fair account of what happened in Salem, Massachusetts, and why eventually the pressures were such that a stop had to be put to it. But my point is that this is a kind of primitive concept of the unconscious. That is, that something that happens to you in your semi-conscious life has a moral meaning, and yet the meaning depends on the conviction that there is what Cotton Mather called an invisible world, and in that invisible world, one of the central actors is Satan himself, and that Satan has his deputies, and that we are from time to time made aware of our relationship to that invisible world in such a way that blame can be attributed fairly. You can point the finger and say, this person has emerged from that invisible world and has interfered in an immoral, in a satanic way,
yeah,
with us.
And in the modern world, Andy DelBanco, we've done what? We have trivialized the notion of Satan so that we reduce him to figures like Freddy Krueger in the movies and the villains in the novels of Thomas Harris. We call it poverty. We call it racism. We call it anything but that intensely personal experience that these Puritans experienced.
Well, you get here very close to the heart of one of my central concerns. I mean, it seems to me that fundamentally, since we've given up, by and large, our belief in this invisible world, if you have a dream and you're encouraged in some way in your dream, as Freud told us we almost always are, to behave in ways that are not socially acceptable,
right,
you call it your unconscious, and you attribute no moral value to it one way or the other. If you encounter someone who has acted on these impulses that bubble up from the unconscious, you are inclined to think of extenuating circumstances, explanations.
Anything but the devil. Anything but to say
well,
the devil.
Well, the devil is a concept that has virtually no...
We've just removed it.
Precisely. Now, the interesting thing, I think, where this paradigm gets complicated, and what I've said up till now is fairly obvious, I think, but where it gets complicated is that the devil has a certain staying power, as is obvious if we pay any attention at all to what we think of as popular culture. I mean, if you look at the newspaper tabloids in the supermarket, which are filled with headlines about improbable, unnatural occurrences,
right,
two-headed babies or miraculous cures or men giving birth to children or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you pay attention to enormously popular movies that we're all embarrassed to admit we might ever want to go to, like Friday the 13th, mm-hmm, or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or whatever it might be, there's some evidence, some very persuasive evidence, that a very large part of our culture is still fascinated and gripped by the idea that these elemental forces that break down all the rules of rationality are out there. And there is, I think, a certain appetite to be in touch with them.
Now, wait, let me argue with you for a moment, Andy,
yeah,
DelBanco. Couldn't we simply say that is a desire to be entertained?
Well, but listen to the way you formulated the question, to be entertained, to be taken out of the everyday world, which,
uh-huh,
is, I think, exactly the point. We live in, as I've used this term a couple of times, we live in a disenchanted world. We live in a world where we have no confidence that there is anything invisible that lies behind it.
So we want to restore it.
I think we do. Now, one strategy that historians and intellectuals of all stripes have used in thinking about this is to say, well, this is a kind of residual leftover from that older world. And one American folklorist used to speak of the underculture in America that he thought of as the customers for these tabloids in the supermarket. And you can say, all right, there's some people who haven't quite grown up into modernity, who don't live in the modern world. In reality, they live physically, but not mentally in the modern world. And those are the folks who take home the Enquirer and go to Friday the 13th. But I don't think that's quite satisfactory. It does seem to me that the sort of great middle class constituency of American culture, which maybe is embarrassed to buy that newspaper in the supermarket, is still finding ways to articulate this combined fear and longing. And so we have all the symptoms of modernity that make it impossible for us to live in that small, closed community that we began talking about that existed way back in the 17th century, where everyone could come together and agree on an interpretation of what the latest event out there meant. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can only really have a providential worldview if you have a group of people who are willing to interpret the world together. After all, if there's an earthquake, and the Puritans ran into this problem, if there's an earthquake or a drought, you can say, well, this is a reminder from God that we should straighten up and improve our behavior.
Well, going into the experience, much less coming out of it, there's a certain set of ground rules.
Yeah, or you can say alternatively, this is a punishment, which means X, Y, or Z about our recent behavior. And the only way you're going to be able to arrive at any kind of consensus about what these natural events mean is if you are a member of a community where the premises, principles, objectives, aspirations are all very, very close together. And those are the questions, it seems to me, that perplex Americans today. They don't know where that point is. They don't have a ministry to tell them. They don't have politicians who are very good at telling them. And it becomes more and more difficult to know the answers to these questions. It's not fun to live in the modern world in that respect.
Andrew Del Banco teaches at Columbia University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Andrew Del Banco worked on a project entitled Representations of Evil in American Culture. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings continues now for the week of Halloween 1991. You'll hear next from Linda Day, a professor of folklore at Indiana University. During her recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Linda Day worked on a project entitled Legend and Belief. Her recent research shows that two-thirds of a random sampling of 1,000 men and women ranging in age from 16 to 65 believe in legends and the supranormal. Linda Day.
The legend came from medieval naming of the readings that are compulsory to read by the monks for each day. But this is adapted to an entirely different term or a different meaning. The word is not to be read, but something that is a very sensitive, subjective communication between individuals. This is a narrative that is unlike the folktale, which is a fiction. Uh-huh. The legend is true, taking place in the real world.
Why we don't associate legends with the Greeks? We don't go back that far to look for the origins of what we call modern legends?
No, we don't. We speak about the legend as maybe it is originating from lesser mythology, mm-hmm. but it has been desacralized. It has no sacred connotations connections.
It's utterly secular.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. But we can talk about legends as belief that is based in belief in the extra-normal.
The extra-normal. For example, spirits that move in the air, water witches, that kind of thing.
Not only that, not only supernormal, mm-hmm. also the horrible. The things that are not easy to explain, the things that are surrounding us, the things that frighten and threaten our life.
From ghoulies and goosties and long-legged beasties and things that
yes,
go bump in the night.
Things that go bump in the night also. Uh-huh. But all kind of anxieties we project into the legends, because human beings are mortals. Life is very fragile and everybody dies and we don't know where we are going. So this keeps people.
Mm-hmm. Can you say, for example, Linda Day, that legend amounts to folk psychology? The way that we have of talking to ourselves and creating stories about the things that we're unsure of in our lives.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Since we are in a permanent danger, we always were, when in the Middle Ages we were also in the same position as we are now. There is medical science, but not all diseases were healed and cannot be healed. People die, people get sick, and we try to do the irrational in order to protect us.
Do we say that legends always have to do with contrast, with figuring out how to get us back to a state of balance and happiness and harmony with all of the world around us?
Well, you put your finger on just the essential, because legend is a question that is very hard to answer. The legend is usually a dialogue, a conversation between people about a topic. Was the ghost there? Mm-hmm. Did the revenant really mean something? And then those who have seen it, those who know or don't know, present their opinion. There are skeptics, they are believers, mm-hmm. they are uncertains, they are absolute those who reject it completely. There are those who are half convinced, half not convinced. I think we can't predict what is happening, but just look at the press, look at into the mass media, mm-hmm. daily news, people communicate fantastic things. This morning I wrote down a CBS night evening report about a couple that was telling that a UFO will come down in Colorado, in eastern Colorado, and pick up people who want to travel to a higher level, and then they will live forever there. And people gathered, and there were 20 people who gave away everything, money, boat, house, kids, in order to join this couple.
Should we generalize from that, Linda Day? Should we say that because the newspapers and the radio and the TV, by nature of what they do, which is to draw attention to the unusual, if not the supernatural, that because we pay attention to those things, they pique our curiosity. We generalize and we say that everybody is deeply superstitious or irrational in their heart of hearts?
Well, the evening news or any kind of media report is coming from us. Uh-huh. We want it. That's why they publish it. The tabloids, each week you get at least 5 legends published. Old legends revived, retold again, or new legends invented, reported. Why do they do that? They wouldn't do it for their own happiness or own fun.
One answer, Linda Day, is to say that they do it because they make money at it.
Absolutely. And why do they make money? Because people mm-hmm. want the answers. Mm-hmm. And the answers, see, the legend is a debate. Somebody says this has happened, and the other said, well, I know also the same thing happened there and there. And the third person would say, oh, no, this is absurd. This can't happen. And then one says, well, who knows? My mother-in-law met this man, you know, and what happened to him? And then come stories after stories being told. Mm-hmm. And there is no resolution. It's a dialectic genre.
What about simply the word coincidence? Doesn't that enter into the discussion?
Yeah.
I mean, why do we make superstition out of coincidence?
Yes. Well, things that are brought together that really do not belong together. Mm-hmm. But people try to interpret an unexplainable situation or condition. Mm-hmm. I have in my collection, I have an old glass which I got from a lady who gave it to me because she told me it's broken, the glass is broken. She got it from an aunt who lives 1,000 miles away, and she went to her curio cabinet and suddenly heard the click, and it just chipped.
Uh-huh. It broke.
It broke.
Uh-huh.
And she said, has just died. She heard that she died.
And that in fact is what happened.
Yes.
All right. Well, now coincidence taken to what? An extreme.
An extreme.
But not causality. Not causality.
No.
I see.
No. But this is brought together after the fact. Many people interpret and bring together things that really do not belong together.
Mm-hmm.
There are no proofs. And in other ways, you know, if you ask me whether I do believe, like many people ask me whether I do believe in revenants.
Uh-huh.
I said, well, there is no scientific evidence to prove that they are, but there are no scientific evidences that they are not either. It is this realm what belongs to our own cultural consciousness. Culturally defined, our society and our age, our times are defining that is giving us notion and consciousness of the world around us.
We worry about not only the security of our own lives, we project it onto the world scenario, as it were.
Yes. You know, the prophecies that fail usually, this prophecy of when... at the end of the 19th century, 1900, that will be the end of the world. Now it's predicted for 2000 again. All fundamentalist religions predict. Right. Now repent. Armageddon is coming.
And we got 9 years to live.
Right.
Yeah, I see.
Now repent and now convert.
Linda Day is a professor at Indiana University. During her recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Linda Day worked on a project entitled Legend and Belief, The Dialectics of a Folklore Genre. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Legend and Belief is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding discussions, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 578. That's program number 578. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, the topics will be feminism and women's studies in the United States and the Middle East. Wayne Pond will talk with Elizabeth Fox Genovese of Emory University and with Booth Aina Shaban of the University of Damascus.
My book is about the state of feminism today and especially about the ways in which academic women need to think about the issues of feminism to address the real concerns of what, for lack of a better phrase, we might call real women in the real world. It is an attempt.
There are many aspects and many nuances to feminism. On the one hand, no one wants to identify feminism there with Western feminism because of the prejudice also against the legacy of Western feminism. So this comes handy to suppress feminism in the Middle East. And this also confuses women.
Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Legend and Belief, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For the week of Halloween 1991, listen for Linda Day of Indiana University and Andrew DelBanco of Columbia University. Linda Day will discuss her study of legend in contemporary society. Andrew DelBanco will talk about Puritanism and representations of evil in American culture. From ghoulies and ghosties to things that go bump in the night, Legend and Belief, this week on Soundings.